Welcome to ID the Future, a podcast about intelligent design and evolution.
This episode of ID the Future features the second installment of an interview of Dr. Stephen Meyer by acclaimed author Eric Metaxas. This series is taken from a recent Socrates in the City event in New York City. View this event in its entirety online at www.socratesinthecity.com.
Well, I guess what I find so fascinating by this, and one of the reasons I was so happy to get you to come here, is that it's ironic, I would say, at least ironic, that the scientific establishment today is as hidebound in a way, and as I said earlier, calcified in their ideology, that they're not even willing to be slightly open to the possibility that there might be an intelligent force. And so they have been tremendously dismissive, as I understand it, of the intelligent design movement. I mean, you've lived this. Why do you think that is?
Well, I have a friendly debating colleague who is a Darwinist, Michael Ruse, who says that he's written an important book in which he explains that Darwinism has functioned as something of a secular religion for many scientists. And many scientists, I think, have had a difficulty distinguishing what you might call materialistic philosophy from the enterprise of science itself. Mm-hmm. So if you have a theory that has non-materialistic implications, or which challenges a theory that does have decidedly materialistic implications, there's an implied threat to a deeper worldview or metaphysical understanding of reality. And I think all of us respond when our fundamental belief systems are challenged, sometimes with some passion
and
zeal.
So their objections are irrational and religious.
I wouldn't say they're irrational, but I think that the level of, or the passion of the response is understandable because of the big issues that are in play.
Are you naturally this kind, or do you just realize that you have to be diplomatic? I have to say, no, that the more I have looked at it, I've been staggered by the, well, how do I put it, the lack of scientific rigor in that kind of thinking, or maybe
well,
just to say
I,
the lack of
I can
of
give
logic.
You a number of it. The week my book was released, it was released on
this book,
this most recent one, June 18th, earlier than summer. By 3 o'clock in the morning, there were about a dozen of these one-star hostile reviews, and some of the turns of phrase were just choice, mendacious intellectual pornography, steaming pile of pseudoscience, that kind of thing. So,
that's great.
By people who clearly had read the book very carefully. And, The day after the book was released, there was a 9,400-word review on June 19th. The book is 400 pages plus with notes. And so this is struck a nerve. There were people lying in wait. So,
well, I'd say that's a compliment. I think that the other thing that one hears, and also I have heard it, is that this is not science. And what these people seem to do, and again, you don't have to take a position on what you believe, but the idea that they're so closed-minded that they would simply say it's not science and are unwilling to discuss it, I guess I wonder what they think science is, because if logic and evidence leads you to surmise that, yes, perhaps there was intelligence behind this, that there's design, it's a logical and a scientific conclusion. So to say that you can conclude anything but that is just strange to me. And it seems to me that they have this idea that anything that kicks against, that shakes up this materialist ideology, really religion, is unacceptable. And so they say it's not science. And because most of these folks are part of the powerful scientific establishment, they can say that. So I guess I want to ask you, what is science to you?
Well, this is part of what I studied in my dissertation years in Cambridge, that it turns out there's a lot of talk about the scientific method, but it turns out there are actually many different scientific methods. And I studied very intentionally, very consciously, the method that Darwin used in reconstructing the ancient past. Discussions of biological origins are, in the end, discussions of natural history. And there's a particular method of scientific reasoning that scientists use when they're trying to study events in the remote past. You can't make a trilobite reemerge under controlled laboratory conditions. So the kind of science that bench physicists or chemists do in the laboratory is not going to be applicable to studying the ancient past. What Darwin did was pioneer essentially a method of forensic science, where the clues that are left behind are used to reconstruct what happened in the ancient past. And he had an important rule of reasoning, which was that if you're trying to explain an event in the past, you want to invoke causes which are, as his mentor Charles Lyell put it, now in operation. You want to invoke causes that are known to have the power to produce the effect in question. Now, I had become fascinated in the mid-80s with this problem of the origin of biological information. It turns out that organisms are chock full of digital code stored in the DNA molecule and other forms of information stored elsewhere. And there is a complex information processing system at work inside organisms that allows them to function and survive. So if you want to build a new cell, if you want to build life in the first place, or if you want to build an animal, you have to have, the evolutionary process would have to produce a great deal of information. But that was the very question that was bringing a lot of evolutionary theories to a point of impasse. And so I began to think about this. What is the cause now in operation that produces digital code, that produces information? And I realized there's only one, and that cause is intelligence or mind. In other words, what we know from our uniform and repeated experience, the basis of all scientific reasoning, is that intelligence produces information, whether we find it in a hieroglyphic inscription or a paragraph in a book or a section of software code. Whenever we find information and trace it back to its source, we always come to a mind, not a material process. And so I realized that by using Darwin's own method of reasoning and his key principle of scientific reasoning, we could make a very rigorous scientific case for intelligent design. So when people say it's not science, I want to say, well, why? It's based on scientific evidence, and we're using an established method of scientific reasoning. In fact, the very method that Darwin used. If the theory of intelligent design isn't scientific, by that same logic, then Darwinism would have to be excluded from that same designation.
I'm sorry, could you repeat that? It's just that you said you were fascinated by something in the mid-80s. I remember that. And it's funny, in the mid-80s, I was fascinated with the Eurythmics. I don't know if you've heard of them. In any case, well, before we get to your book now, I wanted to, to be honest, I was not fascinated by the Eurythmics at all. Before we get to your book, I want to ask you about irreducible complexity. That's another one of these terms that gets thrown around. What you were just saying, essentially, is that the things that exist, these organisms that exist, are too complex, probably too complex, to simply have appeared. And it seems that something with that much complexity, that much information, and when you say information, you mean?
Well, digital code.
Yeah.
Watson and Crick, 1953. They elucidate the structure of the famous double helix, the DNA molecule. 4 years later, Crick proposes something called the sequence hypothesis, which was the recognition that there are four chemicals, they're called bases, that run along the spine of the DNA that function like alphabetic characters in a written language or digital characters in a machine code. And since then, we've learned that that information is directing the construction of mechanical parts.
What you're saying, I just want to be sure. In other words, before Watson and Crick, we did not know about the vast, ridiculous amounts of encoded information in DNA. We didn't know about
it's
that.
It's typographic or alphabetic or digital. I mean, any of those terms are apt and apply. We have an animation online which shows the DNA molecule. It's the the helix structure. Mm-hmm. But along the interior of that molecule, there are these four chemicals. And the chemists actually represent them with the letters A, T, G, and C. And depending upon their arrangement, the molecule is conveying information for building different types of proteins, and proteins are the little machines in cells that do all the key jobs that keep cells alive.
I mean, I remember Francis Collins spoke a few years ago when he was talking about this, and just the level of complexity, just to bring it to that, is just absurd. It's beyond our ability to comprehend. And now that we know that, it seems generally implausible that this just happened, that things of this level of complexity just happened. And so, but then there's something else related. I just want to get this out of the way before we leap into your book. But explain this concept of irreducible complexity.
Right. The case for intelligent design is not so much made in the negative as, well, it's so complex it couldn't have arisen by an undirected process. Mm. It's really made in the affirmative by noting features in living organisms that we know from experience are produced by one and only one type of cause. One of those features is digital information.
Okay,
and that's the argument that I've developed. Mike Behe has developed a separate argument from the presence of a feature that engineers recognize. Engineers sometimes talk about integrated complexity.
Right.
Behe calls it irreducible complexity.
Okay.
And that is a feature of systems wherein you have a great number of parts.
Right.
And if you remove any one of those parts, the whole system ceases to function.
Right, so it could not have evolved. It's not a gradual process. It had to be put together
or it wouldn't work.
The intermediate stages on the way, he makes famous this little, and I kid you not, it's a rotary engine that's inside the cell wall of bacteria. It's called a bacterial flagellar motor. It's high tech and low life. And it's made of 30 protein parts. It has O-rings, bushings, a drive shaft, a hook-like protein that functions like a propeller, and it rotates at 100,000 RPM, can change direction on a quarter of a turn. It's an amazing machine. And what has been discovered by the biochemists working on this machine is that the 29-part, the 28-part, the 27-part version of this is non-viable. It doesn't perform any function. Darwin said that natural selection selects for functional advantage. It preserves those things that pass on an advantage in the competition for survival. Mm-hmm. Well, these intermediate stages have no functional advantage, and so you couldn't build this up gradually, and that's a big part of his argument.
This has been a segment of a Socrates in the City event with Eric Metaxas and Dr. Stephen Meyer. To watch this event in its entirety, visit www.socratesinthecity.com. This program was recorded by Discovery Institute's Center for Science and Culture. ID the Future is copyright Discovery Institute 2013. For more information, visit www.intelligentdesign.org or www.idthefuture.com.